If the shock of adjustment is too great at any time, a death is likely to ensue, or at least a serious mental nervous condition develop. This again was explained by a series of circumstances noted in clinic. One of these is the case I have mentioned before of the small boy who grew up in a few months. He grew from being a child to a man in less than 6 months. At the end of a little period shortly thereafterwards, he also died. The sudden development of the body at a tremendous rate of speed. Not only the body, but the mind. This mind became equivalent to the rapid growth of the body, so that in 6 months, the mind attained a basic maturity that would normally have required 15 to 18 years. The child became mentally a man, with a man's attitudes, his approach to life, his acceptances, his thoughtfulness, and all of the elements with which we associate the normal state of maturity. Postmortem proved that this boy had a kind of abscess or tumor on the pineal gland. And evidently, as a regulator, it lost the power to regulate the growth process. Not simply the body, but the growth of the being in the body. Meaning, of course, only one thing, namely an unbalance in the link by means of which being operates upon body, which permitted being to move into body too rapidly and without adequate controls. And the result, the destruction of the body. So that the gland, therefore, has, through clinical research, more or less supported this presumption or the supposition that it has a regulating effect, and that consciousness itself is in some way released into the general structure through this important glandular center. The ancients, if we can still borrow them a little for further thinking, had much to support this in their legends and their lore and their myths. In a way, this gland seems to play the part of the two-faced Janus, the deity which the Latins regarded as the lord of peace and war. This deity had two faces, one facing forward and the other backward, one assumably facing outward and the other inward. And that this deity represented this gland, which has two processes within it. One is that in its being faced outward, it bestows a superior cognition upon things outwardly seen. And when faced inward, it bestows an intuitional or inspirational insight into the causes of things and into the nature of self. That in both cases, this function is more or less occurring all the time. And what we do not realize, I suspect strongly, in our psychology and other researches, is that man is now, for the most part, looking both ways at once, but as yet has not been able to reconcile the mental confusion resulting therefrom, with the result that we use now the insight that we possess merely to interpret the functions of the outer sensory perceptions. We have not recognized that they possess a power or purpose of themselves. Now, in the brain also, there is this other small body, which is called the pituitary body. Perhaps one of the simplest things that we can liken it to is one of the retorts of an old alchemist. It looks very much like a bottle. It has an anterior and a posterior part, and secretes a material which is called pituitrin. This gland was likewise of great interest to the ancients. We do not know just exactly why they were so fascinated by it, but we can have a suspicion or two about this particular thing. In the first place, the pineal gland is in its shape very definitely a masculine symbol. The pituitary body is a feminine symbol. It is a receptive symbol. And long ago, it was assumed that in the human brain, there were two mysterious bodies resembling embryos, and that one of these was male and the other female, and that all mental or conscious process of the human being was the result of a generation taking place, a process taking place between the male and female polarities in the brain, and that these polarities were represented by these two glands. Thus, in the Parsifal story, the pineal gland plays the part of the sacred spear of Longinus, the centurion, and the pituitary body takes the part of the sangreal, or the holy cup, these two being the wonderful relics of the ancient faith that were preserved in the castle on the top of Mount Salvat in Moorish Spain. Always this castle is on the top of the mountain, and in most of the representations of it, it is a domed building, perhaps slightly resembling our grand old planetarium out here in Griffith Park. But it was always a domed building, and this domed building was the brain. And it was here that the knights of the mysterious service of the Grail gathered for the celebration of the Eucharist, seated around this great table, much as in the table of Arthur, King of Britain, the table of Camelot. And here also we have the same mystery as the 12 paladins of Charlemagne, the 12 knights who represented the servants of the Sangreal mystery. And we have, of course, the orders of the quest. We have man searching for the mystery of the Holy Grail and the spear of Longinus. It is also noted that in the case of Parsifal, when Amfortas, the second king of the Grail, took the holy spear down into the valley to use it against the evil magician, Klingsor, he threw the spear at the magician, who, however, caught it and threw it back, wounding the Grail king with his own spear. This was much made of in the mystical legends, for it represented the danger of using this power for a destructive purpose, even though that destructive purpose seemed to be justified. In other words, reality will never be discovered by violence, even if it is a violent effort to discover reality. It just cannot be done that way. Two wrongs cannot make a right. They simply make two wrongs and things get worse. But the story of the Grail and the Holy Spear also will be found in the legends of alchemy, where we have the mysterious processes necessary to the perfection of the wise man's stone, the mysterious symbol of the immortal soul consciousness of man. The pituitary body, therefore, is known to secrete a mysterious dew that is called the brain dew in the Kabbalah, and plays a very important part in the distribution of energy. The great Belgian chemist, Jean-Baptiste van Helmont, declared the mystery of dew. He said that dew captures in it the rays of heaven, and the brain dew of the ancient Kabbalists is supposed to have been impregnated with the energy of the pineal gland and flowing from the pituitary body. This dew, which has then become the carrier of the consciousness of the pineal gland, is then distributed throughout the body, carrying with it certain power, certain meaning, certain consciousness factor. Perhaps something we do not even suspect, namely that it may bestow a kind of conditioned consciousness upon even the smallest cellular unit in the body. Now, in the case of the pituitary body, we have certain definite indications that this gland will affect health, that it can be held as a physical growth-controlling factor, even as the pineal is a consciousness-growing factor. So that we seem to have here the master glands of a system by means of which consciousness and body are held in equilibrium, and by means of which also the purposes of consciousness and psychic energy are distributed throughout the body. This gives us a possible conscious definition, namely that in the pineal gland we have the seat of consciousness, or the focal point by means of which consciousness and body meet. And in the pituitary body, we have the seat of psychic knowing, this thing that we call the soul. That therefore, psychic phenomena in general, and the disturbances of the psyche in various psychological problems, may ultimately be traced definitely to the pituitary body, where we have certain danger of aberration. That aberration may arise in the pituitary and clarification in the pineal has been suspected for a very, very long time. The development of the pituitary body also seemingly has a very strong bearing upon the sense of smell. That in some way this gland was anciently controlled or directed by means of what were called fumigations. In other words, incense. Various types of odors, as in the story of the frankincense in religion. That the pituitary body responded primarily to the vibration of odor, and that it can be affected and modified in its function by various odors. That as a reaction to this, it means a certain kind of vibration. For odor is only possible as the result of vibration. The gland, in its normal function, has also a body normalizing factor. And in cases of disturbance of this gland, we have the tendency perhaps to obesity, or perhaps again to extreme thinness and loss of bodily quality and sufficiency. The gland, when it goes on one of these so-called rampages, produces a distinct physical condition. Now, it is also noted that wherever this gland with its physical problem becomes acute, we seem to have an increase in psychic sensitivity. Nearly all psychics have been inclined to be heavy. They have been inclined to indicate that a certain type of sensitivity is to be associated with at least a minor imbalance of this gland. And that where the individual is hale and hearty, and the gland is working perfectly, he does not seem to be as much subject to imagination, to violent internal experiences, to a kind of unworldliness of attitude, as we find in a great many persons who have a heavier physical structure, indicating a different pattern of gland function. Also, the effect of sugar on this gland will have to be further examined, because it does tie up in some way with the pancreas. And it's quite possible that the pancreas represents the lower pole of this gland. The function of the various glands through the body are not too difficult. Most persons have had some fair knowledge of them. The principal endocrine glands, of course, are, in addition to what we have mentioned, the thyroid, the thymus, the suprarenal cortex, which is really a double structure, resting in the form of a gland on the cap of each kidney, and the liver, which is the largest gland in the human body, and the pancreas, which is part, of course, in connection with the spleen structure in its function. These various glands have a controlling or regulating action of one kind or another. Let's try and see if we can investigate them just a little more specially. Suppose for a moment we attempt to study the spleen, which is a very interesting gland. And in order to study the spleen, we make a very simple experiment. Let us take a small sheet of very thin rubber, say the size of a sheet of typing paper. And with adhesive tape, we bind this over the area of the spleen, covering the skin over the area of the spleen. If we do this, it will not be very long before we will notice some results. The reason we notice the result is that this rubber protective, which we have placed here, is cutting off certain energy rays. The spleen is like a kind of umbrella. It is almost like one of these radar devices by means of which we can pick up planes at a distance. The main difference being, of course, that the spleen is primarily concerned with picking up energy, not picking up planes. It is a receiving area into which energy flows. And this energy reaching the spleen begins to nourish or support the etheric magnetic field of the physical body. Thus, the spleen is associated with the energy by means of which the vital health of structure is maintained. Wherever there is debility of vital energy, something is wrong in connection with the function of the spleen. But there's no use going and trying to have this diagnosed. Almost anything else will be substituted in the diagnosis. The main fact is that unless the physician follows the Paracelsian corpus and becomes aware that the spleen becomes the gatherer of the energy which becomes the vital principle, that part of man which corresponds to the plant kingdom is sustained by the spleen. Now, the plant kingdom has the power of growth, but not the power of motion. It has the power of color, but it does not possess certain other faculties and powers, and the structure of it is quite different from that of the animal, for example. It represents a less complicated organism with less available function, but it does possess the two basic functions, namely growth and reproduction. Therefore, we must express through the spleen the basic energies necessary for growth and reproduction, and also for color distribution, which the plant has likewise achieved. If then we want to know how man as a healthy plant is proceeding, we have to realize that the growth, energization, representing the plant system comes in this area. I also very strongly suspect that this is the tie between man and what we call cycles of climate, weather, and temperature. That in this we have, perhaps, the field in which the actual relationship between sidereal bodies and man is set up. For here it is that the energies and the energy field of the Earth continuously being modified by the positions of sidereal bodies, that this energy field enters man. Here also we have a sympathetic situation. For here we have what I believe it was our old friend Sir Kemlyn Digby back in the good old days who said that sympathy belonged to this area. That the sympathies between things are carried in energy. Therefore, that compatible energies create vital sympathies. And by vital sympathies, we mean the affinities of things for each other, or the power by means of which like and like mingle. Perhaps under the heading, therefore, of sympathy, if we wanted a good example of it, we might point out the problem of blood transfusion or infusion. Slightly different in process, but not entirely different in meaning. The infusion would be closer, however, to the splenic factor. But here we have a strange blood introduced into a system. This blood must be overcome by the blood of the person, and its own vital field must be permeated by the vital field of the person receiving the blood. There must be an electric, vital, magnetic victory of the person over the strange blood which he has received. To a smaller degree, there must be also this victory of the individual over every element of food that he takes in. Because he is taking in a dissimilar, which he must make similar, or he can do nothing with it. This similarity factor, this sympathy, appears to be largely under the control of the spleen. If, therefore, this becomes damaged beyond a certain degree, the individual cannot live. This is one of the indispensable parts of man. It cannot be sacrificed. In fact, for the most part, the glands cannot be totally sacrificed. There are one or two that can be, because when that occurs, if it is necessary to remove them, their burden is carried to another gland of somewhat compatible purpose. As, for example, the transference of the responsibility, mutual transference between thyroid and parathyroid. Each one can take something that is necessary if needed. And the glandular system, if deprived of a function, redistributes that function over the surviving glands, if it is possible to do so. Some, however, this cannot be done with. And anything happens to these glands, there is no answer. If the kidney is removed, the suprarenal is generally left, because it is not possible to spare some of these glandular structures. They are too subtle. Yet we are not aware of why they are so necessary. Now, the liver is the largest gland in the body and is also probably one of the most abused. We recognize in the liver, in the apex of the great body of the liver, the great lobe, the center of, well, for our purposes, let's be rather blasé and say the center of the beast in us. This is the center of animal life. As the spleen supplies that which is necessary for the continuance of a plant, so the liver provides the extra things that are necessary for the survival of an animal. Without the liver, man as an animal can't make it. Therefore, the liver has to do with the warm blood factor by which an animal is distinguished. The liver, furthermore, has to do with motion. It has to do with motion and emotion. And the entire possibility of man as a warm-blooded creature developing a whole pattern of emotional reactions to motion. The relationship of the entire sensory structure to the blood circulation. In other words, an animal has senses, the same as man. They are not bound by the same coordinator, but the sensory perceptions are there. The animal can see, it can hear, it can feel, it can taste, and it can smell. Particularly in the sense of smell, the animal has tremendous superiority. This superiority can only mean one thing, that in the animal, the pituitary and the liver have formed a companionship far greater than in the case of man. In man, the power of the pituitary has gradually been shifted to the pineal. And as a result of that, in many levels of function, man is less self-sustaining than an animal. Perhaps even lacking certain judgment that an animal possesses in a rudimentary way. Certainly an animal can determine friendship and false friendship more quickly than man. It can also find its way home when man is totally lost. The animal does possess certain powers. And the highest power of the animal, seemingly, has to do with its psychic propensity, which goes back to the pituitary body. But we have man as an animal operating through a combination of glands in which the liver and the pituitary constitute dominant factors. Now, where do we find, for example, the mineral content? Man is also a mineral. Man is bone. He is substance. He is matter. He's worth about $8.50 now as pure mineral content. He used to be worth only $1.25, but minerals have gone up since those days. Also, we've discovered a couple of new elements in man that are quite expensive. So his value as merely a chemical compound is rapidly rising. Perhaps he will be ultimately a good investment. Who knows? But the mineral part of man comes back again, not so much to the endocrine system as we know it, but to a degree it gives us a clue to this particular structure. Actually, the mineral part of man is linked directly to the life part. Actually, what is a mineral? A mineral is apparently a mass, a substance. That it has certain energy waves of some kind moving in it is pretty well established because of the crystallization forms which we find in the mineral. The mineral is crystallized around energy. But the mineral does not move. It does not grow. It does not reproduce as we know it. And it has only a kind of survival, with the exception of certain minerals. There are links between minerals and plants in the same way that there are links everywhere in nature. But the mineral is an existing thing. It is alive, but it is not living as we know it. And this, according to the old authorities, was due to the fact that the human heart has two complete structures involved in it. An internal structure in which life is seated, and an exterior field surrounding that structure, which is the basis of the form principle. That matter is therefore held in cognizable form from the outer magnetic field of the heart. Therefore, actually, matter is not included upon in the glandular group. even as the ancients pointed out long ago, that the physical body is not a principle. The physical body is a receptacle only. It is not a principle. Upon this receptacle, seven principles operate. But it is the eighth sphere, or the sphere of their activity. Matter, therefore, is a kind of eighth principle, directly related to life itself. The vibratory polarity of life and matter is in perfect harmony. And for that reason, the physical body is tied as a living thing to the structure of the core of the heart, and as a condition or an enduring form to the outer part of the heart. The heart contains or controls both of these processes. We do, however, have certain other, what you might call, luxury processes taking place in man. One of them is represented largely by the thyroid. Now, the thyroid gland, which of course is located in the throat and has a peculiar structure, almost wing-like in appearance, has long been associated as a gland which has to do with growth, with bodily equilibrium, with body chemistry, and perhaps generally speaking, it is a sort of pacemaker. The thyroid is a sort of district manager. It is up to the thyroid to accomplish at given times and under given conditions processes which are imposed upon it by other glands. The thyroid is the efficiency expert in the glandular group. It is the power which takes upon itself many different elements and works them into a proper pattern. And if by any chance this pattern process is lost, a series of glandular reactions of several different kinds appear almost immediately. In other words, if this gland gets out of equilibrium, the body, so to say, gets completely out of focus with the patterns of its purpose. Therefore, if there be an archetypal pattern of body function, this pattern is enforced by the thyroid. Now, we might say, is the loss of the thyroid, or part of it, through surgery, therefore a terrible spiritual disaster? No. If man's spirit could have been destroyed by science or surgery, it would have been gone so long ago, we wouldn't any of us have any. These are not disasters, they are inconveniences. And it is undoubtedly true that there are occasions when various parts of man must be sacrificed to preserve the rest. This can happen. And as the purpose of man is to experience the growth and development of this world, it is better that he be here to experience than he sacrifice the total experience to preserve some theory about a single part. This would not be considered good, reasonable procedure. Therefore, the thyroid or part of it may be sacrificed. If so, other glands immediately take over to carry this load. And, of course, the load is sometimes partly carried by the liver, partly carried by the parathyroids, which under normal condition should not have to operate, and partly, again, by the pituitary. What part of it is taken over by the pineal, we do not know. But there is much to suspect that something could be, for the reason that an archetype or a pattern or a coordinator is the primary function of the pineal. Therefore, this may be a relay station in the pineal chain. In fact, in a funny way, all the glands are relay stations of one gland, the pineal. It is the master of them all. The parathyroids are not supposed to have too much activity under normal conditions as the child develops. But we do have now some problem which involves the element of heredity. We have a problem in which the child in a certain early period in life seems to receive and be sustained by a parental energy. Up to a certain time, the child is unable to carry its own energy requirement. And this energy requirement is reservoired in the parathyroids and in the thymus. These glands operate, therefore, under certain stress patterns. And especially the thymus. It is assumed that as the child grows older, that this gland will gradually cease to function. And where it does not cease to function at the time when it should, there seems to be a retarding of the development of the person. Now, this retarding by a hyperthymus condition has been a subject of a great deal of thought and discussion. But again, we have not arrived at any two positive conclusions. The general tendency seems to be to feel that the continuation of this glandular process beyond its time may result in a lingering psychic relationship with parent. In other words, if you have a condition which you might call psychic dominance, or if you have a condition in which two identical twins are constantly psychically aware of the condition of each other, or you find a peculiar psychic sympathy between people so that they seem to know each other's thoughts or emotions, particularly as the result of long association, people sort of growing together, growing like each other, growing so that they almost have one mind between them, or one set of reflexes. It is suspected that this has to do with an unusual lingering of the thymus function, and that this function, therefore, impairs, if it is extended, impairs the assertion of individuality. That the individual never quite comes into possession of himself as he should if this gland lingers in its functioning beyond a reasonable length of time. Usually the activity of this gland is pretty well exhausted by the time the child is 7 years old. But there are cases where it is not exhausted, and we have an involved and complicated psychological situation that can result from this perpetuation. Thus, it becomes obvious that there can be a valid link between glandular function and disposition, temperament. Dis-ease, which we call disease, is really a kind of psychic discomfort. The being is not at ease. This at-easeness will also often reflect the function of the adrenal materials, particularly the adrenaline in the body. The suprarenal cortex, therefore, has been likened to the gland of internal security. There are people who seemingly are undaunted by circumstances. They remain almost continuously sufficient for all of their needs. Needs as people, needs in emergency. These are assumed to possess an exceptionally well-developed and balanced suprarenal process. When the individual is under tension, stress, anxiety, or particularly in danger, or feels themselves to be in a predicament or in a disaster, the tendency is for adrenaline to develop and flow more rapidly. Thus, it has been called the courage gland, because it is this flow of adrenaline which gives the individual the sudden power to meet emergency. When this gland operates normally from a reasonably healthy organism, it gives the person that necessary push that takes him through a situation, whatever that situation may be. Nature has provided him with a reserve energy center, by means of which he can meet a stress of unusual intensity. It may, however, be that through continuous emotional stress, he exhausts this. If he does, then this energy is no longer available because he has wasted it. It therefore is very important in the life of the individual that he does not permit himself to become overwhelmed by small problems. If he is so overwhelmed, he will have very little energy resource when a major emergency arises. This gland sort of gives the person the push that takes him over the top in whatever his problem may be. It is the same kind of result, almost, that in old times, carters got by beating a horse, whipping a horse. This spurt of energy, by means of which the horse was able, under cruelty, perhaps to achieve the end that was desired. But, of course, the life of the horse was shortened, and its health was ultimately destroyed. But this gland provides the whip of energy, by means of which a sudden emergency can be met. Nature, therefore, has provided even for contingencies of this kind. We must sometime recognize that these glands constitute specializations of energy, that they are in a very large measure very much like the chakra situation. In fact, in some groups among some groups of students, the glands and the chakras are very closely related. I do not think this was the original intent, however. I think the glands represent another group of factors. Plato was of the opinion that the entity or the power in man, controlled by means of eight powers or eight extensions, and these extensions form the mysterious symmetrical solid called the Ogdoad, which was the symbol of the soul. The eight powers of the psychic or of the internal self. Now, we have to be a little careful because the word soul does not mean quite the same in Plato as it does in Christianity, for example. By soul, I think Plato probably meant what we call consciousness, because Plato does not use the word consciousness. Therefore, I think to the Greek, this concept of consciousness, or the ensouling power, rather than soul as we think of it psychologically, that this ensouling power manifested through a septenary and one more, the eight. That the septenary represented essentially the glandular system, the eighth representing the outer body of the heart, which supplied the physical body, the eighth being the body itself, the lost sphere or the underworld of ancient philosophy, which would be corresponding to body. So that the septenary of the glands represent a kind of chord, a musical scale, a group of vibratory rates, which the old Egyptians and Chaldeans tied immediately to the planets, which they regarded as in turn the seven spirits before the throne of consciousness. Thus, the glands represent the elaborate chain work by means of which consciousness plays upon the body as upon a musical instrument, causing all of the most subtle variations of its own purposes to be available in body process. This process means not so much merely physical control as the release of consciousness in its various aspects through all of the activities of body. We think of consciousness largely as merely supplying us with certain spiritual volitions, supplying us with certain intellectual intensities by means of which we are inspired to do this or that or something else. But that is only consciousness on one level of expression. Consciousness must be present in the cell. Consciousness must be ever present. Consciousness must be present in process. And by means of this group of glandular structures, the possibility of this direct involvement of consciousness in every aspect of the body appears to be sustained. Now, it was anciently noted also that actually the glands in the body are reflexes of polarities set up in the pineal gland itself. That the gland itself is a sevenfold structure. That the light or magnetic energy which emanates from it is in the form of a spectrum. And that in this spectrum, there are the planet-like cores by means of which the gland is tied to each one of the body glands below it. Thus, the actual contact is, of course, vibrational. It has to be. But there has to be the vibratory power in that gland in order to create the reflex, as in the tuning harp or tuning fork, in each of the other glands, which is vitalized by reflex. Thus, the energy moving through these glands really represents the motion of consciousness on all of its various levels in the body of man. When you get this entire pattern more or less organized in thinking, we therefore see this consciousness flowing downward through vibratory waves and touching like the rising sun striking the peaks of mountains. First, the high points, and these high points in man's function are the glands, later lighting the whole body. Now, man's mental nature, or the mind-brain pattern, forms again a kind of circumference around this, so that we have in the heart the core, which is life, and the circumference, which is body. We have in the brain the core, which is consciousness, and the circumference, which is intellect. Now, intellect is to consciousness the same principle as body is to life. Because here we have body becoming the instrument of life, mind becoming the instrument of consciousness. Life flows into body, consciousness flows into mind. Mind, in turn, by virtue of these relationships, is also capable of a reactional process by means of which thought or sensory perception or experience or attitude goes back or flows back into the consciousness core. By that I mean only one simple situation, namely that the bridge of the pineal carries traffic in two directions. From the plus direction, consciousness moves across the pineal to take its mental polarity in mind and its physical polarity in the glandular system. At the same time, the body reflexes and the mental reflexes are carried back into consciousness. And at the dissolution of the body at death, all of these polarities are restored. The pineal gland is the last area of activity to remain alive, and through this vortex, all of the testimonies of the lower centers are carried back into consciousness again. So that it is a two-way road. But behind the glandular system is the real being in the body, operating upon the body, moving through the body, by means of these highly vibratorially poised centers, each of which has an energy rate. These are all this machinery is kept in motion by the vibration of the pineal gland. The moment that ceases, they all stop. But each one has a specialized function to perform. And the coordinated testimony of that function is again returned into the pineal center. Thus, for man, birth or growth, the processes of development, our consciousness moving into body through the glandular system. The process of the severance of man's body at death from consciousness is that the consciousness in every atom and cell gradually unites and flows back again as a consciousness experience into the pineal center, from which it is transferred to consciousness per se, and then the gland has fulfilled its purpose. But man's being a conscious person in this world is largely a matter of the essential functions of these glands. Not the superficial function, but the essential function, about which, unfortunately, too little is known, but about which some very valuable thinking can be done on the basis of analogy. And we have enough to support the general picture, even on a scientific level, but we do not yet have all the information necessary to fill in the details. These must come in time, but they're going to be too late for tonight, so we can't do anything more with it at this time. So I think we'll call this the class, and we'll meet you again with another class a little later, but I have an announcement I would like to make, and that is that on March 29th at 8 p.m., our friend Dr. Bode is going to give a talk here, 8 p.m., March 29th, on Indian culture through the ages, and the lecture will be illustrated with films prepared by the government of India, which are on loan to Dr. Bode for this occasion. I believe it's going to be rather unusual because I think it's going into all of their crafts and cultures, their arts and things of that nature, and their cultural traditions through the ages. It should be a very interesting work, and the films, of course, have been very carefully prepared by the Indian government. So I think you will be interested in it, and we hope that many of you, as can, will be here to be with Dr. Bode on March 29th at 8 p.m. Thank you very much.